The Senate Education Committee, please come to order. This is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014. It's 8:02 a.m. In attendance are myself, Senator Stevens, Chair, Senator Dunlap, Vice Chair, Senate President Huggins, Senator Gardner, and Senator Stedman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're considering two bills, Senate Bill 216 relating to child abuse prevention and House Bill 162 relating to teacher tenure. We have CS for Senate Bill 216 before us as our working document, version N. Senator Dunlap, could I have a motion to adopt Senate Bill 216 version N, working document?
I move that we adopt working document version N.
And Senate Bill 216.
Senate Bill 216.
Thank you. And I'll object for discussion. So we have version N before us. And Senator McGuire's staff is here. Thank you very much. Amy, if you'd come forward, identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning. My name is Amy Saltzman, and I'm staff to Senator McGuire. The senator will be here momentarily, just so you all know. Just to speak to the changes, the only change from the original bill into the CS was that we removed the task force. We had conversations with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and they have had task forces in the past. They have a lot of working groups, and they're working on this issue, so we felt that it was unnecessary to have another task force, so we removed that portion. And that's the only big change. The rest of the bill is pretty standard and straightforward. If you'd like me to go through that now.
Okay, thank you. Yes, please.
So Senate Bill 216, or Aaron's Law, addresses a devastating epidemic of child abuse, and it will help to empower our communities by educating children, parents, and teachers, and give them the opportunity to speak out. This bill does this by requiring school districts to develop age-appropriate sexual abuse and assault awareness and prevention from ages kindergarten through 12th grade. And this bill is part of a national effort that's been spearheaded by Erin Marion, who she was an advocate, and she's a sexual abuse survivor. She's made it her mission to enact this legislation in all 50 states. To date, there are versions of Erin's Law that have been enacted in 8 states. 25 states, including Alaska, have have a version of this before you. So, and here's the senator.
Thank you very much, Senator McGuire.
Last week in Juneau, we had the opportunity to meet Erin, and she is such a strong and powerful advocate for this cause. We have her testimony here that we'd love to share with you. It's very powerful, and she really speaks about some of the devastating statistics that have come forward. You know, national statistics say that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18. And another statistic to share, which is also in your packets, is that the Office of Children's Services show that in 2013, more than 2,000 allegations of sexual child abuse were found in Alaska. And that's more than 1,800 individual victims, with over 40% of those being Alaska Native children. So we have a devastating problem in our state as well.
Thank you very much, Amy. Senator McGuire, thanks for being here. Any comments you would have at this point?
I think Amy did a great job. Let's listen to Erin's words. I was over in the other building, so let's listen to her words.
Children are not just being abused in my home state of Illinois, they're being abused around this world. But it's that silent epidemic we don't talk about. We look the other way, pretend it's not going on, when I guarantee every single one of you in this room knows somebody that has been affected by sexual abuse. But the scars are invisible, and the stigma and shame that is placed on this issue, we don't talk about it as a society. We'll talk about juvenile diabetes, cancer, autism, bullying. But this is one of those things as a society that continues to go on because we fail to address it. As you heard, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused by the age of 18. Well, I was one of those children, going off to my very first sleepover as a little kindergartner with my best friend. She lived in the home with a single parent, just her mom, a little brother, and an uncle. an uncle that lived in the home and acted as the caretaker while Mom worked. And it was at this overnight, this man came into the room and woke me up when I was sleeping and sexually abused me for the very first time. Did I have the language to go home and tell my mom as that little six-year-old what this man had done? No, I didn't. I didn't know how to speak up and tell and explain to her or my father what had happened. So I kept it a secret. Well, as we know with these perpetrators, they don't stop. They'll continue to abuse a child and keep them silent as long as possible until they get caught. And that was the case for me. From 6, 7, 8 years old, this man repeatedly, times I went over to her house overnights, sexually abused and eventually raped me as nearly a 7-year-old. The only message I got from this man was, "This is our little secret. I know where you live. If you tell anybody, I'll come get you." So I stayed silent. I lived in that fear because that was the only message I got, being brainwashed to think that he would come get me, nobody would believe me. All the red flags were there. Suddenly that sweet little kid that I was began to act out. Suddenly they had to hold me back, repeat first grade. They had to have one-on-one aide that constantly was working with me because of the tantrums I threw in school, putting my hand through a window. The anger that I had was very relevant that something was going on. But no one was asking those important questions, teaching me on safe touch, unsafe touch, safe secrets, unsafe secrets. So they eventually labeled me with an IEP, individual education plan, with behavior an emotionally disturbed child. So as this continued to go on throughout my childhood, not speaking up about it, all the behavior problems there, what finally made this end? Well, it wasn't somebody coming into the classroom and teaching me like they had been with Stranger Danger. Not look for that lost puppy, don't take candy from the stranger. Yet 93% of the time, children are sexually abused by someone they love and trust. I guarantee you, if you get a room full of parents and you ask them if they've talked to their kids about Stranger Danger, every hand will go up. I'm sure every one of you that's a parent in this room has talked to your kids about Stranger Danger. But when it comes to sexual abuse prevention, that if someone is ever inappropriately touching you in the areas that are covered by your swimsuit, you speak up and tell. Rarely does a hand go up when I ask parents that. And usually that one hand or that two hands that do go up, it's because that mother or father was sexually abused as a child by somebody they knew and trusted. So at 8.5 years old, I found out we were moving. I was getting away from this perpetrator, this man that had done these awful things to me that I was still keeping a secret about. I started a new school. But of course, as I made new friends, I never wanted to spend a night because I feared the men in their home. Only, unfortunately, to get that much closer to my next perpetrator in my life. Was it that man that pulled up in that rusty van, that stranger, asking me to take candy out of his hand? That man that walked up with the leash, asking if I've seen that lost puppy? No, not that Stranger Danger that I had been warned about. This time it was a family member, at age 11, waking up in the middle of the night, to this older teenage cousin sexually abusing me. And of course, the abuse didn't end after once. It went on from age 11, 12, 13, birthday parties, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and soon it happened weekly while we were over at their house because they lived just down the street from me. This cousin repeatedly told me, "This is our little secret. No one will believe you. If you tell anybody you have no proof that I'm doing this, you will destroy our family." This is the only message I was getting, once again, as a child growing up. But I knew how to run out of that burning building, duck and cover from a tornado, evacuate that school bus. And as you guys do here in Alaska, the earthquake drills that we don't have in Illinois, we drill these kids with all this powerful information on safety. But this is one thing we failed to address with kids. I also learned in sixth grade for 6 weeks the 8 ways to say no to drugs. I still got my little dare card here. And I can tell you all right now, I have not so much as put a cigarette in my mouth because I know the consequences to doing drugs and smoking. Because I was repeatedly told. I never caved to the peer pressure. Because I was continuously told by a police officer for 6 weeks the consequences to this. But the only message I got growing up as a kid was to stay silent and listen to my perpetrator. And of course, the school poured thousands of dollars into me with resources because of my behavior problems that nobody knew were going on at home. I kept my secrets locked away in a little childhood diary And I'm going to read to you just one little passage, which I was reading as an adult that made me go on this crusade to pass this law in every state. I sobbed the whole way home. Over and over my head, I thought about what just happened. In school, a guy called Officer Friendly teaches us about strangers. Never answer the door when my parents are gone. I thought people, like Brian, jumped out of bushes and attacked you at night. They don't teach you in school about your own family. It was those words that I realized they don't teach us in school about the people you know and trust that can hurt you. And there are kids across this world that's the only message they're getting. I can give you the perfect example of what happened in Pennsylvania with Jerry Sandusky. That one little boy that had been abused back in 1998 knew how to speak up and tell because he had been educated. How many more kids for the next decade could have been saved, put that man away, but instead the only message they got was from Jerry Sandusky? Because you see, these perpetrators will victimize as many kids as they can get away with. The average sex offender in a lifetime has 114 victims. Think about that for a moment. And the other startling statistic is there are 42 million survivors of sexual abuse in America alone. 3 million of those are children. Those 3 million kids could fill 46 national football stadiums. But we often can't put a face to these kids because the physical signs are not there that they're being abused. So I have made it my life mission to go out there and put a face and voice on the silent epidemic and give children the voice that I never had as a kid. These men had stolen my innocence, they took my trust, but the one thing I've been able to reclaim from them is my voice. And I decided to turn this into something positive instead of negative and do something good for kids, and giving that 7-year-old that's being raped tonight by her stepfather the ability to go report it tomorrow at school, instead of being repeatedly abused the way I was as a child and not coming forward until she's in her 30s and in drug rehab, finally telling somebody why she turned to substance abuse, why they turned to the eating disorder, the self-injury, the suicide attempt. You see, hearing these statistics, you know it's a national epidemic. And what finally gave me my voice at 13 years old wasn't that educator coming into the classroom and teaching me about sexual abuse prevention. It was finding out that my little 11-year-old sister was also being sexually abused by this same family member. You see, they don't stop. They'll get away with this for as long as possible. So I've taken this crusade state to state. I resigned from my full-time master's level job as a counselor in Illinois to go after this law, to convince legislators that we need to give kids a voice. It was passed yesterday, where I testified 3 weeks ago in Tennessee, making it the 12th state to pass this law. There are currently 26 more states that are currently voting on it, and I've literally been traveling this month alone to 4 states now, Alaska being the 4th, and we'll travel to 3 or 4 more next month to testify to legislators to get this law passed so that we give kids a voice in every state. Because as I tell people, this epidemic is not going to end. And while I would hate to sit there and put this responsibility on kids to speak up and tell, we can't rely on parents to sit there and have this conversation. Because often the perpetrators in the home, or as I said, parents don't know how to have this conversation. There are people in the schools where it will cost nothing to educate kids. You have here in Alaska your health teachers. I spoke with the superintendent when I arrived here in Anchorage, and they've been doing this for 15 years in numerous of their schools, the health educators who are already salaried positions coming in and teaching the kids this. In my home state of Illinois, we've been using the social workers and psychologists that have been going into the classrooms and teaching kids this. They've been learning it all year in my home state since it passed, and they've already had several disclosures. One case, a police department called me and said a girl that had been repeatedly abused for several years by a family member finally came forward. They were fortunate to get a confession out of this man. And when they asked this 12-year-old what finally made her speak up after all this time, she said it was because they taught us Aaron's Law in school that day. She waited after class and told her teacher. As I say, if this law can save just one child in every state, and give them a voice and end their horror, then it's well worth my passion and mission to go to every state and pass this law. I certainly hope you will hear my message today and support this law, because as I tell legislators, I won't stop in getting this law passed in every single state.
Well, thank you very much, Amy and Senator McGuire. That's shocking, and I'm pleased for you to present this to us. Any comments you have in addition?
I do. Well, thank you. And I'm, for those of you that got to meet Erin in person, she's a very compelling person. And for those of you that didn't, I'm glad you at least got to hear her video testimony. She's a remarkable woman and a survivor. And I always think it's a remarkable when people can take their life tragedies, particularly childhood tragedies, and turn them into stories of survival and recovery. What I want to emphasize about this law and about Erin's story and my work over the last 14 years in this area is that it really does work to educate young people about the danger of those around them touching them inappropriately when they're young and the ability to have a voice. And that's the thing that I want to educate this committee about, is that this little requirement that we can put into the school districts to ask them to go that next level, which many of them already are, to talk about not touching under the swimsuits, to ask them to make a list of 5 trusted adults that include more than family members, in case one of the family members that they would go to, for an example, isn't willing to accept a conversation if it is a family member that is the sexual perpetrator, will go a million miles in this state toward cranking down on this epidemic that we have. And I know you know, Mr. Chairman, that Alaska leads the nation. And so for all the states that could adopt Erin's law, we should be one of the ones that do it. We're always mindful of putting more on the school districts, and I think that we have to be careful when we do that. But as it is, under Title 18, 66.310, we already have asked school districts to educate, to be trained in domestic violence awareness and sex assault. So now what we're saying is we'd like them also to be trained in the area, and it seems even more appropriate to identify signs where children may be sexually abused at home, and to give a basic training course in it. Erin talked a lot about the nonprofits and resources that are out there, not just within our own state, but nationally, that are willing to provide and already funded the education that is out there, saving money to the school districts. She talked about some of the training that's already given to school students, and I was going back thinking about those myself. The Stranger Danger, the DARE program, Stop, Drop, and Roll, getting under your desk, all those things prepared me. And I teach them to my sons as well for just the minimal dangers that are out there in life. But I never once received any training or discussion about the potential for sexual abuse. And I feel very fortunate that I was not the victim of that in my lifetime. But I do know people. I do have friends. I do have colleagues that were victims of sexual assault in their lifetimes, by strangers and by family members. And it is an epidemic in our state. And I think when you heard Erin talk about, you heard her mention just the one case, but I got an opportunity to hear her mention a couple of other circumstances. And I just want to describe one to you, that one of the health teachers in Illinois, after presenting to a group of students a basic lesson about the swimsuit and where good touch and bad touch and good threat and bad threat, if you will, conversations, and then the notion of going to 5 people that you trust, it was just a half-hour conversation, and afterwards 6 kids came up to that health teacher in confidence to tell this teacher that they had been the victims of sexual abuse. And, you know, as she mentioned, just if you can save just one child's life, what we know and that we've spent time in our judiciary committees over the last 14 years that I've been involved, Mr. Chairman, the consequences of sex assault on young Alaskans and the adults that they become are phenomenal. They lead to suicide. They lead to drug and alcohol abuse. They lead to incarceration. They lead to death of souls. And I think that's what I want to emphasize, is that when your body is taken from you at a young age without your consent, and it's confusing to you, and there's no one to go to, or as you heard in the case of some of these young people who do tell a trusted adult, and that adult tells you you're wrong or that you're lying, it's even more confusing. We just need to do all that we can for this epidemic, and this is one step in the right direction. And I think the more that we can do as leaders, and it's uncomfortable even here today to talk about this, isn't it? This is uncomfortable to have these words on the screen. It's very uncomfortable. But this is the step that we can make as leaders to begin bringing this out into the light of day and saying that we are not afraid to talk about this. And we're not afraid to listen to young people, and we're not going to let these perpetrators win by allowing the silence and the perception that there is something dirty or bad about these young people either. And so I thank you for listening to this morning, and I thank you for allowing this uncomfortable subject into your hearts and minds and being a part of the solution.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Any questions or comments, Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an area that we probably all talked about. Some people hang their head about, but the question I've never been able to figure out, my assumption, the fact that we lead the nation has nothing to do with latitude, longitude, but why, in your opinion? Why do we lead the nation?
Great question. Through the chair, President Huggins, some of my research on Arctic issues actually does show that there's a little bit of a latitudinal link, a little bit. Northern climates, it turns out, most of us lead the nation in sex abuse, in alcohol and drug addiction, and in suicide rates. So there is a little bit of that. In fact, one of the things that we're looking at for our work in, the Canadians are looking at it right now, Leona Okachok, who's the current chair of the Arctic Council, has made this a mission. And then we're hoping the United States does too, to look at suicide rates, drug and alcohol abuse, and sex assault as part of the Arctic Council mission. So there is a little bit of that. The other part of it is isolation. It turns out isolated communities, isolation in general is one of the things where perpetrators win, because the more isolated you are, when you're being abused, fewer points of contact, fewer people there to help you out. So one of the things Alaska has is isolation. We've got communities that are off the grid, removed from major networks of communication, and so that's another thing that we have working against us. And it turns out that ends up winning out in other communities in the lower 48, too, where there is a vast difference between urban and rural communities as well. So that one happens as well. Also, high levels of drug and alcohol addiction. It turns out that where there's high levels of drug and alcohol addiction, also the rates of sex assault on children go up, too. So all those things linked together make Alaska right for these kinds of things. So I think when we look at the problem, it is complex. I think we're looking at then trying to heal the drug and alcohol addiction, which I think comes back to some of the economic things that our majority has been working at. You know, how do you give people across the state hope for economic opportunities? And then there's you know, certainly trying to work on safe houses, giving people who are isolated, particularly children, a sense that there's someone they can tell. And that's part of the Aaron's Law, is saying who are five people that you can tell. And maybe it's a superintendent, or maybe it's an elder or a community member, a pastor in your community that you can tell. but it's complex.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. The other question that we all often wrestle with, and Aaron cited, is the 16-year-old cousin.
Yes.
Okay. The point being is, according to who you talk to, you get a different answer about the curability, the treatment of, and as I recall, we have the provision of sex abusers, where they can live, three strikes, registering. But can you talk us through that just as a refresher?
I will. Through the chair, Mr. President. This is also something that, you know, I've spent a lot of time working on over 14 years. There is pretty solid evidence at this point that the recidivism rates in the area of sex assault are very high, above 80% in the area of sex assault on children. And for that reason, I've been a part, along with other members, here in this body, putting together the three strikes you're out law, essentially, that by the time you've sexually assaulted a child in the state of Alaska, you're sentenced to life in this state. The notion being that you're just too dangerous to release back into our community. Oregon has had some success working on what they call a containment project, where they monitor you for life with an ankle monitor. And they use a combination of lie detector tests and monitors. And what they do is they essentially say, you know, are you putting yourself in a position where you're around schools or exposing yourself to children on a regular basis? And when they reveal that information, they put them back in prison again. I think the rates for recidivism are lower with younger people, but they don't look good. I mean, they don't look good, I'll be honest with you, on sex assault against young people. And you heard the Sandusky case, and you also heard Aaron's statistics, that by the time we catch somebody who is sexually assaulting a young person, the odds of them having assaulted over 100 young people are very high. And that is why it is so important to try and catch somebody at that early phase, because they are serial offenders, perennial offenders, football fields, stadiums full of young people. So that's my answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question. One of the things you hear from some suits of people is that particularly young people, but people in general, that are guilty of sex abuse were abused. Could you help us out with that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there's a lot of literature out there on that I have read, and if you were to have someone here who was clinically trained, they would tell you that is, if not almost always the case, in the high degree of the case, that those who are sexually assaulted, and even in some cases physical assault, they'll cross over into the sex assault arena, but that abuse, the cycle of abuse, repeats itself. And that's the other part, and I appreciate your questioning. It's great, because it's highlighting the reasons even more for not only this bill, but why we want to try and nip these things in the bud early on. You've got these innocent souls, Alaskans, entering our great state and the potential that they have, and you think about that sex assault and an Erin and the surviving that she has and that she's gone on. She's got her first baby on the way, and the statistics that she has overcome. You heard her say she chose not to become addicted to alcohol and drugs. She avoided all of those other traps and has gone on to be this heroine. But yeah, the statistics are the other way for many, many, many people who are abused. They go on to perpetrate and abuse. And in fact, those who are abused young will go on to abuse other people when they're young as well. So it's a cycle that just repeats over and over again. And I would say that for Alaska, going back to your other question, that's another thing that we see statistically, is families where that abuse has, alcohol addiction and abuse, the cycle has just continued on generationally.
Mr. Chairman, I said one more, but that really is one more question, if I might.
You can take all the questions you have.
It has to do with gender.
Yeah.
The one we don't talk about.
Yeah.
It's overwhelmingly one gender, but there is a gender factor. Could you just walk us through anything you might have there?
Yeah, and thank you, through the chair, Mr. President. Overwhelmingly, it is the male gender. There are instances where...
Who are the perpetrators?
Who are the perpetrators. There are instances where women sexually abuse young women and young men. And there are those instances, and they're called out, and when we see them societally, but... and Senator Dyson, you know, talks a lot about this. He's another leading senator in this area. But statistically, it is men who are the perpetrators, both against, and I want to emphasize, both against young women and against young men. Young men are the victims of sexual assault as well and carry a tremendous burden as a result of the sex assault that is perpetrated. We have some cases that have occurred here in the state of Alaska that have led to suicides, and you can recall many of them have risen up in the paper, Rita Holdhouse's son and some other things that have been just awful cases, coaches and other things, but it is the male gender. And so it's just something that, particularly I look at my male colleagues that I admire so much, and appreciate your leadership and how all of you, you know, stand out and everything that you guys do, and Choose Respect Day to take a lead. And on this issue, I appreciate your leadership, too, to stand up and say, you know, for the young men that are out there that may be the victims of something like this happening, that they shouldn't feel shame either, and that they should have a voice and be able to come forward and say, this is unacceptable, and to break that cycle of violence and be able to move forward in their life as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for the questions. The going to the bill itself, Senator, I understand, you know, as a legislature, we can ask the district to work with students and with teachers to make them aware of this issue. But you also mentioned parents. What can you do with parents? I mean, it seems to me there's been a big change in the last 40 years. I was not aware of this when my kids were young very much, really. I mean, I don't even believe we told them that the issue of stranger danger. But I now know that my grandchildren are going to be prepared. And so what can we do to work with parents? That seems to be one of the key issues.
I think that's a wonderful point, Mr. President, and it's a sadness to me personally, as a parent of four school-age boys, you know, just a reflection point, how little some parents choose to be involved, frankly, in their children's lives at this day and age. I mean, it really is a travesty, and I know that's a travesty for the school districts and the teachers. Because I talk to our teachers, and you know, and they have in many ways become de facto parents. I mean, and so I want to say thank you to them and to the principals, because it used to be the case that, you know, my parents were responsible for all of that, and then we'd go in and we'd learn for the day and then come home and get the parenting. Well, it's not that way anymore. So I'm looking at the bill right now, and I think an improvement could be made, Mr. Chairman, and perhaps it could just be conceptual language to say, number five says methods for increasing teacher, student, and parent awareness, but you could beef that up if you wanted to. I'm open to anything this Senate Education Committee wants to do with respect to emphasizing the parent involvement. I mean, I think this has got to be, we don't want to simply say that we're shoving this off onto the teachers. I agree with you. On the other hand, there's a realization, certainly on Aaron's part and on my part, that this may be the only awareness that a child gets. It may be. They may not get it at home. That's the reality of where we are in 2014. But should we completely shirk a parent's responsibility? No, not at all. So I think they're what we want to try to do is say, let's spark a conversation. Let's put tools in a child's tool belt. Let's get us talking about it. I even mentioned the idea of PSAs, public service announcements, age appropriate, you know, but some kind of thing about, you know, this is your swimsuit area, and who are your five trusted adults? Who are your five trusted adults that you can go and talk to? Because some kids, frankly, are homeschooled, and some kids are in private school, and we don't know how information reaches them, but I'm open to whatever language you'd want. The place where parents are mentioned is on page 2, line 5, where we talk about methods for increasing parent awareness.
Great. Well, thank you, Senator. I appreciate you bringing this before us. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, please.
Senator Huggins.
Yep. Senator McGuire, there's in Alaska sometimes a significant number of parents, according to the subject, that say, you know, I can do that.
Yeah.
I would prefer that my child not be exposed to whatever the subject is. Is there a provision in the bill for that?
Through the chair, Mr. President, I would assume that this goes in under the regular parents are allowed. This is my understanding, and we can get back to you. But parents are allowed to opt out of sex awareness. That is the current district policy. There's a parental permission slip, and this is going to fall in there. So it goes under the regular title. We're putting this in under Title 14, under the regular district policies. But I'll get back to you to make sure that it does fall under that category. We're not creating a new area. We're putting it under the regular sex education unit. And currently, parents are allowed to say they don't want their children to be a part of that. They are allowed to do that.
Well, it's a very good point you bring up, Senator Huggins, certainly we want to make sure that parents are in control. But on the other hand, the parents could be the perpetrators. And
that's right.
Yeah, so it's an issue
that we need to discuss.
I mean,
Senator Stevens, Mr. Chairman, it is a complex issue for that reason. And that was kind of my thinking when I thought about this idea of PSAs. And I thought about this idea because, you know, when kids are watching cartoons, there are, again, age-appropriate public service announcements on drugs, or on a stop, drop, and roll, or whatever the thing is. And my thought was, is there a way to talk about this subject? And I don't know the answer, but that you can kind of penetrate through the silence barriers, because this is a crime of silence. And that was the thing that struck me so much about meeting with Erin, that at these two different times in her life that this happened to her, The way that the bad guys, if you will, won was the silence, and that she had no idea that she could tell anybody, and thought that truly, if she told, that she would be physically hurt, killed, and that her family members would be as well. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gardner.
I think that part of the silence is that kids are often put in a position of protecting people, protecting their family. You know, it's a stepfather who says, you know, it'll destroy the family and I'll have to go to jail. Sometimes the mother might even know and choose the man over the child. I mean, or sometimes the mother has experienced sexual abuse herself, and either it's so walled off. I mean, this is one of the greatest tragedies that she doesn't protect her children. It's not at all unusual for children who are victims to have parents who are victims. And either they accept it as normal, or they just can't look at it at all. And so it becomes generational, a great deal of denial. So if parents were allowed to opt out, I think that would, in some respects, kind of impact their children's ability to hear a lesson they might need to hear. And I'm any opinion that this can be done very delicately. You're not kind of explaining to talking to children about being raped directly, yeah, but simply about being touched in a way that's uncomfortable to them, or being asked to keep secrets by somebody that's not your mom. You know, I mean, there are good secrets and bad secrets, yes, just like there are good touch and bad touch. So you can keep Christmas secrets, but if somebody does something with you and says never tell your mother, that's probably a wrong thing to do. So, well,
thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I support the bill and the essence of the bill, but Senator Garden was talking about it can be done delicately. We know that Murphy's Law, mm-hmm, according to who is in front of the class, some people aren't delicate. I mean, we have to accept. And I don't want to go down that road, but, you know, that's the way parents think, you know, sometimes. I don't want that teacher right there talking to my – I'm always sensitive to parent and parental prerogative.
Thank you. I appreciate the discussion, and I'm just really sorry that we are receiving this so late in the game. I'd like to work with you. The two issues I think I brought up here is what can we do for further parental involvement and helping them understand that? What can we do, as Senator Huggins brought up, the parental rights as well? So obviously we're not going to move this today, but I do want to move it soon. So let's work together and see if we can find some solution to those issues and move it right on. We have a lot of people that want to talk to this, so thank you very much, Senator McGuire. Thank you, Amy, for presentation.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate Aaron's presentation as well. I believe we have someone here from the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Council. Is Laurie? There you are, Laurie. Thank you for being with us. And Laurie, if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. For the record, my name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you for hearing the bill this morning and for your continued interest in how to create a safer place for children in Alaska. I just wanted to briefly mention that part of what the Council's responsibilities are to assist school districts in developing curricula. Right now it's in statute for domestic violence, but we also do work with them on sexual abuse and sexual assault. And I also wanted to mention an initiative that started in this past year through the Governor's Choose Respect, where the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and the Council went out into the state and held focus groups of parents and asked them, what can we do to support you in having these conversations with kids? And how can you move forward? How can we create a safer space? And Mr. Chair, if I might, I would just hand these to you. They're the first step in a series of cards for parents. And the campaign is called Talk Now, Talk Often. And it's simple conversation starters, questions that parents can use to help get familiar with what's going on in their kids' lives, what the kids don't know and want to know, what their interests are. This first set of questions is fairly generic to get the conversations going. There are going to be other sets of questions coming out over the course of the next year to several months that are going to be more sensitive in nature and starting talking about safe touch, unsafe touch. So there are parents across the state that are interested in helping their children cope with unsafe situations, and the primary barrier of doing that was they didn't know how to talk to their kids, and they didn't know what to say to get started, and they asked for helps, and so this is one of the helps. There's also a website called Talk Now, Talk Often, that's for parents and gives them other information and tips. So there is something starting in the state with parents. We also had this past summer a two-day conference where we brought people together from pre-Head Start, Head Start, preschool, parents as teachers, elementary schools in Anchorage. They have a K-12 curriculum called social-emotional learning. And there are different of our funded programs who have worked with their community school districts and have K through 12 education in the schools in their health classes. So with the current law that says encourages, I think Aaron's law is going to take it a positive step forward in requiring this kind of education, and it will help us move forward into school districts where maybe we haven't been able to before. So I just wanted to let you know that we stand ready to assist school districts. We believe it's important to have skills development because, as to the president's point, sometimes you need to know how to say it before you can effectively say it. And there are some, not just teachers, but any adults who may have a difficulty saying it or may be a perpetrator themselves. And, you know, it's something we have to think through and look at. So I also just wanted to let you know, because I have understood that sometimes cost is a concern in school districts in providing this teaching. On the Office of Children's Services website, there's a curriculum called Reporting Child Abuse in Alaska. And anybody who is a required reporter can go on to the, well, anybody can go onto the website and take the class, but it's specifically for mandated reporters of child abuse. And it takes them through a series of lessons about identifying child abuse, how to respond to disclosures, and what they are required to do. So it's a first step. It shouldn't be the only step. There should be, I think there should be continuing education in how to identify child abuse and these problems. But there is something out there that's already been produced. It was in conjunction with the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, ourselves, the Office of Children's Services, and the Department of Education. So some time and thought went into that. And then also like to let you know that for the past 6 months, there's been a work group with the council, the network, the Department of Education, Health and Social Services, the Association of Alaska School Boards, and other community representatives, and looking at K through 5 curriculum. And with the goal of coming up with 2 to 3 different choices of what we think would be best practices for our state. They have not identified those yet, but they are working with them because there are nationally some evidence-based curriculums on the subject. And so they're looking at that. And then I guess lastly, what I would like to say is you may have heard of the fourth R. You know, the three R's are reading, writing, arithmetic, and the fourth R is relationships. And it's a curriculum for 7th, 8th, and 9th graders that is evidence-based in Canada that we have brought to Alaska and adapted for use in Alaskan schools. There are, I'm going to get the number wrong because I didn't write it down. There are over 53 schools that have sent teachers to have the training. I believe over 200 have been trained. We were not able to conduct a formal evaluation all over Alaska where the curriculum is, but we have selected schools where we have been evaluating the project for the last 3 years. And this summer, we're going to come out with the findings of that research. And early indicators are that it is going to be beneficial for Alaskan students as it was for Canadian students. And so the council has been very thoughtful in how to encourage school districts in implementing curricula. We want it to be something that works for them. We don't want to put something out there or have people just try something and think, oh, this is it, when really it's not it. So we're carefully planning how to get the information into schools, and are glad that you're looking seriously at this and think the requirement is a good step forward. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Just remind us, who are the mandated reporters that you referred to? I mean, if you don't recall, that's fine. But
I will get back to you. There's a list in statute in Title 47. It includes teachers. It includes healthcare professionals. It includes victim service providers. So I'll get you that list.
Okay. Police officers, I assume.
Yes. And, yeah. I'm sorry, I'm afraid if I continue to try to name them, it'd be like the Seven Dwarfs and
okay.
I'd miss some.
Thanks, we'd appreciate it. Any further questions, Laurie? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Boy, I enjoyed reading through your cards. They're thought-provoking. Just for a moment, I'm going to ask you about bullying in the end. But, you know, I think of the social interaction phenomena amongst our children. That one is the most visible.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are probably the most sensitive to, but it may be the most difficult to address if what I hear is true. But help me out about how we're doing, and if you go to a K-12 school and you say, how's bullying going here? What would you tell me?
Through the chair, President Huggins, I agree with you that it is a serious problem, and it's probably more prevalent than what we would want to know about. I think, though, that there are peer educators. There are youth in high schools and middle schools who are interested in leading respectful, strong lives and who want to be good mentors to younger students. We have a couple of different programs. One is Coaching Boys into Men, where high school athletes are taught through their coaches about respectful treatment of women and girls. And several of those high school youth, both in Juneau and Ketchikan and other areas of the state, have developed their own talking points to go into the middle schools and talk to young men about that kind of behavior. I think public awareness is helpful. I know there are several national media campaigns. We have two public service announcements that run on television that address high school dating violence and look at bullying behavior and what to do. So it is a concern, and there are probably people more educated than I on exactly what's going on with bullying, but there are efforts being made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. For the question, Senator Carter.
Thank you. I have kind of two things. Number one, as I visited all my schools this year, I had a list of things to ask them about, and that list included their compliance with the newly mandated suicide prevention training, and also what they were doing about bullying and how things were going in their school. And what I heard over and over again, the schools in my district were working with the social and emotional learning program, SEL. And I got to see that at every level from, you know, kindergarten up through 12th grade and what they were doing. It was actually very interesting to me. And it, you know, my takeaway is it was sort of focusing on helping kids to identify their own emotional state and responses to people around them and have a vocabulary for that, and also to understand other people's. So that, you know, with a first grader, they might say, well, when you said that to so-and-so, how do you think that person felt, and how did you feel when you did it? But they had a lot of different scenarios that weren't directly for this child or that child, but it was actually, I thought, very, very interesting. The other thing I wanted to say is in terms of who is a mandated reporter, you know, these lovely little tools here. The following persons, this is statute 47-17-020, the following persons who in the performance of their occupational duties or with respect to Section 8 of the subsection in the performance of their duties have reasonable cause to suspect that a child has suffered harm. And the people are practitioners of the healing arts, school teachers, and administrative staff of public or private schools, peace officers and officers of the Department of Corrections, administrative officers of institutions, child care providers, paid employees of domestic violence or sexual assault programs and crisis intervention and prevention programs, and members of a child fatality review team or multidisciplinary child protection team. So, and that says if it comes to their attention over the course of their duties, but it also says it doesn't prohibit these people from being reporters if it's their non-occupational activities, if they happen to learn it, you know, if it's a neighbor or something. They still, of course, anybody can report it. Anybody can.
Thank you for the comments. Thank you very much, Laurie. I appreciate your comments. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you on this issue.
Thank you. We have
a couple of other people who want to testify. Jessica LaMaster with the Alaska Children's Alliance. Is Jessica online? Ms. LaMaster, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Just fine. Please identify yourself for the record, if you would, Jessica.
For the record, my name is Jessica LaMaster. I'm the executive director of Haven House, the domestic violence sexual assault shelter in Homer, and we operate three child advocacy centers across the Kenai Peninsula. So I'm a member of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and also serve as the chair of the Alaska Children's Alliance, which is the network of child advocacy centers in Alaska. And I'm also the mother of a toddler, and it's with all of these hats on that I testify today in full support of SB 216 Aaron's Law. So in my experience working in child advocacy centers, I've personally forensically interviewed hundreds of child victims of sexual abuse. And it's their voices that compelled me to express my deepest hope for the success of Aaron's Law. So at the end of each of these forensic interviews that I conduct, I ask the child to identify safe adults in their life to whom they could report further harm. And sadly, in my experience, some children, even ones with safe support systems, are unable to name a single person. So when children struggle to think of safe adults to, you may assume it's because they don't have access to any. However, it's often because children don't know it's okay to talk to trusted adults about something so personal, so uncomfortable, or so confusing. They don't want to burden us, or they feel shame or blame and fear negative reactions from grown-ups who they want to please. And in Aaron's case, many children have also been threatened of what will happen if they do tell. So Aaron's Law will go beyond just awareness. It will reduce stigma around disclosing abuse, and it will assure children that it's okay to tell, that adults care, and that adults will protect them. For decades, we've expected children to simply say no to abuse, as if they have the power or responsibility to prevent it on their own. We've sent the message to children that it's not only up to them to know what's inappropriate, but also to just say no and make it stop. But the reality is that children are incredibly vulnerable, and dynamics of child sexual abuse are complex. Children don't have the power to protect themselves from harmful adults. It's up to us to protect them. And sometimes child sexual abuse is hard for us to talk about because it's painful or uncomfortable, like many people have already talked about today. But let us consider the message that our silence sends to children. If we are not comfortable talking about it, how can we expect children to be comfortable telling us about it? So I believe it's time that we realize it's the responsibility of adults, of leaders in the state like all of you here today, to protect our most vulnerable citizens. The epidemic of child sexual abuse, like Aaron and Amy and others before me said, affects 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys, and we have to make these odds better for our children. So I believe Aaron's Law is a significant step in the right direction, and I just thank you all for considering it and for listening today.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica, and for the work you do. Surprising to hear that some kids can think of no one that they could safely talk to. That's, I suppose, the reality of life, but sort of shocking to hear. Any questions of Ms. LaMaster? Again, thank you very much, Jessica.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gardner.
It's not really a question for Jesse, but I know of cases where a child comes into state custody because of abuse, and the members of the family, the adults, can't think of a single safe person they know who can take care of those kids. Mm. So I guess it's not surprising that some kids can't think of one either.
Sure, sure. Of course. Thank you. Flora in Fairbanks, is it Rody, R-O-D-D-Y? Flora Rody, are you with us?
Right.
Oh, right here. There you are, Flora. Thanks for being here with us. And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please, Flora.
My name is Flora Rody. I am from Fairbanks. I work for the Fairbanks North Star Girls School District. I'm a member of the Education Support Staff Association. I'm a member of NEA Alaska and NEA. I was going to say I support this personally, but reading through the packet, I see there is a letter from our president, Ron, for in support of this. So I can say NEA Alaska supports this bill. The next part is purely personal. And I appreciate hearing the testimony from Erin. I'm glad I was here to see her testimony. I don't know how many people noticed how emotional I got during that testimony.
I did, as a matter of fact, and appreciate how hard this is.
It is very hard. I grew up with an alcoholic grandfather I found out as an adult that most of my aunts and uncles and possibly my mother were abused by this grandfather. I have an uncle who was one of the abused, who went on to abuse his step-granddaughter, I believe it was. I think this is good that we're going to teach our children to be able to find someone they can trust and make it stop. I have a a cousin who lives in a village who has 8 or 9 or 10 kids. The 17-year-old daughter of my cousin ended up hanging herself, and we didn't know why. Eventually, we found out it was because she was molested by her own father. So this touches many lives, not just city lives, not just village lives. All children need to know how to find someone they can trust to tell and make this stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laura. Well, I know very hard to give this testimony. We certainly appreciate your being here and your heartfelt testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Karen Robinson from Juneau. Karen.
Good morning, Senators. And
good morning.
For the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Alaska Women's Lobby. The mission of the lobby is to defend and advance the rights and needs of women, children, and families in Alaska. We strongly support preventing sexual and domestic violence against our children. Many of the lobby steering members who were victims ourselves helped develop some of the early programs designed to use in our schools today. Today, with the support of Governor Parnell, the Council on Domestic Violence, and most important, with the leadership of Lori Martin, you have a vibrant council and a confident staff to help carry out this policy. This should obviously give you comfort. I think most of us have the same vision when it comes to domestic violence and sexual assault, and that's stopping it. We've come a long way, but it's taken a long time, and we still have a very long ways to go. Alaska from the start was very unique. We insisted that the new State Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault be in the Department of Public Safety. This put Alaska years ahead of the nation in recognizing that women and children victims are not sick and in need of mental health services and treatment. They are victims needing medical assistance, police support, just like any other crime victims. We recognize that stopping domestic violence begins with education. Many communities from across the state continue to lead the nation by offering comprehensive services in our schools, educating our parents, educating our teachers and our kids with a K-12 curriculum. In the 80s, actually, Bruce Johnson, back there, who was the superintendent of our school district, and myself, while I was director of the shelter, the AWARE shelter here in Juneau, developed a curriculum. And we basically worked with other agencies in town. We used to have a men's program that worked with domestic violence and men who were charged with being perpetrators, and we came up with a curriculum, and it had a three-pronged approach. We started by first going in and doing a training with all the teachers in the district. Then after we taught and worked with our teachers, we went in and we did a training with all of our parents. And every parent also got the information regarding domestic violence and sexual assault and how to talk to their children. And then thirdly, we went in and then talked with all the children within the state. We recognize that stopping domestic violence, I said, to start with education. As I understand it, today we still have some very strong programs in Bethel, Kenai, Fairbanks, and Juneau. But yes, it's time to do more. In the beginning, the number of children who came forward after hearing the presentations were obviously overwhelming. But we weren't prepared for who were going to be amongst the perpetrators. The director of the youth program here in Juneau, and his victims were boys. He went to jail, got out, victimized more boys in this state, went to jail, got out, went to Florida, victimized more boys, and in Florida, he's in jail for life. We also had the Assistant Attorney General who helped a group of us rewrite the child sexual assault laws. And again, in one of the programs that we had out at Glacier Valley School here, his wife happened to be substitute teaching the day that we did the training, and her children were in the schools. They came forward. Again, he was convicted after being notified of the fact that his children had come forward. He plowed himself into the telephone pole out by the hospital, but still spent time in jail. The president of the school board and also head of Big Brothers Big Sisters. Again, his victims were boys. We know today that at least one of the boys he victimized committed suicide. And how sad that is for all of us. We also had ministers. We had fathers. We had brothers. Other family members and friends. And the worst was the lead sexual assault investigator in this town who I worked with for 10 years. Again, his victims were girls. And because of the statute of limitations, he got off scot-free. And that's why we went in and changed the laws regarding statute of limitations, where it went to 10, and then we changed it where there is no limit, which is extremely important when you're talking about victims of child sexual assault. He also was the sole child sexual assault investigator during those times, and I'm still haunted over the 80 cases in which he made the decision, both as the investigator, pretty much as the DA and the judge, to deny all those cases to go forward. I also know in those cases that one of the perpetrators still walk in the streets of Juneau, a lawyer, and two of his victims also committed suicide. But today, with all the work of the past 30 years, physicians do routinely ask children if they are safe at homes. Teachers are required to report suspected abuse. Many children learn early about the difference between good touch and bad touch. Reports of domestic violence result in arrest. Offenders are locked up. Shelters throughout the state and Alaska and the nation exist, and women are still telling their stories. And men are still telling their stories because, as I just went through, how many of those cases were not just girls but were boys. The governor, obviously you as a legislature, law enforcement, schools, and health providers, you know, have really responded in the state. And Senator Huggins, that's one of the reasons through the chair that I believe we have such a high rate. You know, that victims really are not alone in the state any longer. But yes, it's time to do more. It's time to guarantee that every child from all the way north, all the way south, gets the same curriculum, that their parents get the information, that the teachers get the information, but we also have to make sure we have the systems in place who then come in and help prosecute these cases and give some relief. Because if you don't, as you heard, you will have more victims from the same perpetrators of the children who came forward years before. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. Well, you brought up some additional issues, and we appreciate that and your knowledge and experience. So you seem to be saying that one of the reasons we have such high rates is that we may have good reporting and that kids have been taught to come forward. And
well, I think we've had a very strong system in Alaska. It's not always been strong. The council has had good directors and have had very poor directors. Mm-hmm. The good news is right now we have a very solid, educated, well-versed in these issues director heading up our council. Not only did Lori used to, you know, not only is she the council director, she also was the director in the Bethel program. She also was the director for 10 years of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and that's critical. It's also critical that the Council on Domestic Violence be strong. And not everybody agrees with me on this one, but when we set it up under Governor Hammond, again, he was the governor in place when we put this in, and one of the leaders was Terry Miller, who we have a building named after, the lieutenant governor. He worked with me and others, and Karen Perdue, you guys know her name. She was also at the table in making sure this council was set up and it was strong. Our idea behind it was supposed to be five members, the commissioners. It says designee, but we really wanted the commissioners at the table. In the early days, the very first council, Commissioner Nix, who was the Commissioner of Public Safety, he sat at the helm as chair. I personally believe that that's, I know we have experts, and yes, they need to be there working with their bosses, but we need the bosses at the table, and we need them all sitting down and talking about how we can turn the curve here. But yeah, I believe it's because we have a very strong base. I think it's because we immediately, we fought other programs from the lower 48. One of them was called the Giaretto model from California. Their philosophy was that you brought the families together with counselors, that the father was just as much a victim as the mother, as was the child. And they put them all in the same room and tried to get them to work out what the problem was, instead of recognizing that, no, the child was the victim and the father was the perpetrator. But we changed, you know, here in our state, we chose to go more with the Harborview model out of Seattle, and that was clearly the child was the victim. So I do think it has a lot to do. We also have had a very strong shelter network. We originally set up 5 regional shelters in the state. I think we have 21 programs now. And again, it's been through the domestic violence and sexual assault programs that this issue has been brought to the forefront. We were unique in the fact that in the lower 48, many of the programs are separated by child sexual assault programs, domestic violence programs, and sexual assault programs. And except in Anchorage, again, like in Wish and the Ketchikan area, also out near in the Palmer, they take care of it. It's a program that has the umbrella of all services under it. So we very quickly saw, as we started working with women who were victims of domestic violence, that quite often they were victims of sexual assault, and then unfortunately their children were also victims of abuse or sexual assault themselves. And so we started recognizing things that others, I think, were not recognizing as quickly. I think probably the saddest thing for a lot of us was just the fact that many of us found out that our own children were victims before we had the kind of information we needed to talk to them.
Thank you. For questions, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks, Karen. You said a number of things that strike home. You know, I happen to have a degree in criminology and have gone through lots of these things, and, you know, I'll go so far as you mentioned people going to jail and they get out of jail. I'm one of the people that says that we as a society are just a observer of all this going on. I mean, you have dedicated your life to it, and you can report to us time and time again the people, but we send people off to jail, we turn them out, we know what they're going to do. The recidivism rate is at least 80%, if not greater. We know what they're going to do. We know who they are. We say, okay, you're back out on the street. You know, the one that saddens me is Governor Parnell has made this a cornerstone to his administration. And, you know, sometimes he gets poked about that. That disappoints me because you may disagree with the technique. You may disagree with some of the results anecdotally. But on the other hand, he has been persistent and he has been consistent. And, you know, I think some of us ought to pile on a little stronger to help him out. I know Senator McGuire is doing it in the essence of what we're talking about. But you know, and I know, these jails we talked about, you go to Lemon Creek, and it is a vegetable soup of how you fail in life, all right? And it can be domestic violence, it can be abuse of children, and oh, by the way, you refine the techniques of all those kinds of things, and all the hierarchy of bullying and run by power brokers and all those things, and then we dump them back on the street, knowing what's going to happen, particularly when it comes to abuse. So in your tenure, I've finally got to my question, in your tenure of dealing with this myriad of social ills, what 2 things have you learned that you would like for us to take away?
Wow. I also want to thank Governor Parnell. I agree with you that he has been a very strong leader in this issue, and I think he has definitely raised through his Choose Respect marches. We used to call them Take Back the Night marches, and it's great to have a person as high up as the governor. And as I've talked about, he's not the only one. I mean, it was Governor Hammond and also Governor Knowles. There was quite a few governors who have really tried to tackle, you know, this issue. Matter of fact, Parnell and I served together when we passed the 1996 domestic violence laws here in the state. He was the sponsor on the Senate side and me on the House side. So I guess most important is all of us really taking it serious and rolling up our sleeves and trying to figure out, and it doesn't happen without money. That's just the facts. And really making sure that we have all the support systems we need out there in all the communities from Beryl down to Metlakatla, and that when a child reports, I mean, I stated, you know, we have children reporting. I mean, I just had a call yesterday, breaks my heart, of a case here in town where the woman through Susan Clark, Jim Clark, you probably know him, his wife, she and I worked together on these issues back in the 70s, and she had this woman call me where very clear a man has sexually abused, even, I guess, the judge in the during the child support cases. I truly believe that he's molesting the children. And every year she has to, I guess, get a protective order, and every year he tries to get custody of the children, and she has to go through the whole trauma again. We need to stop that. And I think the other thing is I just really encourage you, bring the victims to the table. We used to bring the victims to the table. They have a lot to say. They've gone through a lot. They can tell you a lot of what we need to do. And so I think that's what I'll leave with you, is just make sure they're at the table. We have a tendency now, because we have the big programs and we have social workers and other people and directors now who have degrees. Many of us, you know, we came in it too as victims ourselves. We didn't start because we had big degrees. And I think we need to make sure they stay at the table at every level.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing, and I'm going to mention the term capital punishment. I'm not trying to convince you to support capital punishment, but let me just make my case. Right. And I am a supporter of capital punishment. And let's take Aaron. All right, we listen to Aaron and a lot of other young men and young women. Some states have capital punishment for taking a life. Bang. I would submit that people that are perpetrators are taking their life. And it's doubly bad, because they have taken the life of the person. You know the echoes of what that causes, the grief in that person's life. You have taken their life. So it's probably worse. But it's doubly worse because we've already talked about those same people that we took their life become perpetrators. So we have started the cycle. So I'm not asking you to run out with a capital punishment banner, but I firmly believe that is probably worse than killing someone, because you kill multiple people in a chain reaction that will proliferate itself through generations. Thank you very much.
Again, through the chair, President Huggins, it's another mission of mine, is I believe strongly we have to get to our boys early. We got to get to our boys in elementary school. I have a grandson that lives here in town, very close to me, and he's only 12, but about the height of you three men sitting here. He's going to be one giant in our family, who I try every day, you know, and lucky that he has a mother and father who are giving him some really good, solid support and upbringing. But I believe we have to get into the schools. I personally believe even in the schools, we know already, many of us victims were, our first victimization was when we were in high school by our boyfriends. And I wish that we could have programs when the first time a person goes to their counselor or to their school nurse or to their teacher and tells them that my boyfriend hit me last night, my boyfriend threatened me with a knife last night. That we could get them into early counseling groups right there in the high school to deal with their violence and to help change their behaviors. And that's critical. We have to start there. And, you know, because the stories are not just starting now. I mean, it was my father was also 21 years military, and I never quite understood why he hated one of my uncles. And it wasn't until literally about the time my parents both passed that I found that my mother was a victim. And she never told me all the years I worked in the field. And so it's not now. It's been a long, long time coming. And, yes, we need to do what we can early on, working with those young boys, making sure they're not victims, because they are victims, and helping them to maybe make better choices and learning how to deal with their behaviors early on.
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I just thinking about the issue of capital punishment, and already children, you know, can be threatened. No, but they can be threatened about telling. If you tell, this, and this will happen, and they buy into the secret. And if that is hanging over the perpetrator's head, you know, if it's daddy or mommy's boyfriend, and the child is terrified, hates the person, they're complicated emotions because that person, it's not the whole definition of the perpetrator. It's like, why do women go back to their abuser over and over again? And they'll tell you because then he's sorry and he's so sweet afterwards and this and that. It's not, the abuse isn't the entire person. And so it makes things really complicated. And the consequences should be swift and complete. But if execution is hanging out there, I think it'd make it much more difficult for people to report it.
No guillotines, though.
It's through the chair and Senator Gardner. I think, you know, the other thing that just kind of reminds me that, you know, the other thing we have to guarantee is Max DeBraw, who is the teen center director who molested many of the boys on Boy Scout camps and went to jail when he got out. It was actually ironic. I happened to be in Anchorage, and my son at the time, who's now 42, was around 12. This is the age of my grandson. And we sat down, and there sitting next to us was Max, who just got out of jail, with two boys, little boys, sitting next to him. I knew they were the victims. I called the Division of Family and Youth Services. I called the district attorney's office. I said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So I understand no one ever went. No one ever checked. No one ever checked that situation out. He never should have been with those boys in the first place. And as I was telling you, he did then get charged again, and again we let him out. But we have to start by also making sure when they get out of jail, you know, that we guarantee that he's not having access to other victims.
Thank you for the comments. Thank you very much again, Karen. If there are no other, there's no other testimony, we'll close the public hearing. I certainly don't want to delay this, but I want to get it right. And we want to work hard on this to make sure we do get it right. It's such an important issue. I do want to hear from the districts because they are going to be the ones who have to implement this. So we want to hear from them. We want to see, is there a fiscal note we need to deal with? This does go to finance next. We have an amendment ahead of in front of us on your table, but I think we'll, with everyone's permission, I think I'd like to wait and roll that into a CS. We'll work with Senator McGuire and attempt to come up with that. She may not want to put capital punishment in her bill, but that's something that she I mean, I know that's a very serious issue, but it's one that we do need to deal with. And further questions or comments at this point? If none, we will set this aside and hold the bill and try to work on it. Thank you, Senator McGuire. In the few minutes we have left, we also have Senate Bill 162 ahead of us. I did mention to Representative Wilson she didn't need to stay. She has a finance committee. Is Barbara Barnes here? Barbara, any comments you have? Okay, thank you very much. Department of Education, Mr. Morris, any comments you have on Senate Bill 162?
Thank you. This is a teacher tenure bill.
For the record, Les Morris, Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Education, Early Development. The department really doesn't have comments on the bill, but I did want to make sure that we made ourselves available if you had any questions for the agency.
Okay, thank you so much, Les. Appreciate your being here. Any questions of Mr. Morris? Yes, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Does the department have a position on the bill?
We don't have a position on the bill, and if I might explain why, tenure really doesn't affect the department. It does affect teachers in schools. It affects districts in terms of their processes. But in terms of the department, it actually has very little effect other than it affects all the agencies or all the districts that we have a regulatory oversight over.
Okay. Thank you very much, Les. We also have Diane Hirschberg. Is she online, or is Diane here?
questions?
I'm just 1 second. She's online. Okay. We also want to get to Diane Hirschberger from ICER, and so we'll probably go a little bit beyond our time limit. Senator Hargis.
Yeah, thank you. Les, we heard previously that tenure wasn't portable when you move from one district to another. I walked away from the impression one of the presenters, I think it's portable in the, it, to the extent that I believe you have 1 year for review of the person before they regain their tenure. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it is portable, but you have 2 years.
2 years.
There was a short period of time in the late 90s, I believe, that it was a 1 year, and then the legislature adjusted it to 2 years. So it's 1 year less than the regular 10-year route. So it's 2 years, and then on your third year, you have that portability that allows you to get tenure, whereas normally it's 3 contract years, and then on your 4th contract year, you have tenure.
Yeah. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, that's an interesting I was thinking of the psychology of why we have that. Okay. So I'm a teacher, and I'm in school district X, and I move, and suddenly I have 2 years to prove to the new guys in district Y that I should be tenured. But help me out with the psychology of that. Someone, it wasn't just magic that we said we wanted teachers to start over again. What was the psychology behind that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the way I read the statute is that one of the conditions is you must meet the evaluation, the performance standards of that school district. To have them completely transfer their tenure and have no restart would mean that one district A has to completely trust that the teacher they hire from district B is going to meet their performance evaluation system in that new district without even having an opportunity to review that. So I think what this builds is time to say districts may have different sets of criteria in their evaluation. They're somewhat standardized across the state because there are state standards, but local boards can put in place things in terms of their evaluation. So this allows that local board to do that check on that. It was 1 year at one time for a very short period, and districts, I think, really said that that's just too short, and so it was made to 2 years. But I think that's the philosophy behind it, is it's one criteria is based on meeting the local evaluation standards.
Does this bill in front of us affect that 2 year in the new district, that tenure at all, by extending it from 3 years to 5 years? Is there any impact on that 2 years, or is that somewhere in statute right now, 2 years?
It's in statute right now, and I'm sorry, I actually read the bill, and I can't remember if they changed the portability piece or not. Okay, well, I don't know that they did.
Yeah, we'll look at that. I just remind you that Representative Tammy Wilson, when she gave her testimony, one of her earliest comments was that maybe this should entirely be up to the districts to establish all the rules on tenure, and why are we even having a bill? That was one of her comments to begin with, so that's always an important issue to consider as well. Thank you very much, Les. Appreciate your
back.
Sure. I think we have Diane Hirschberg with us. We've asked her to comment on this matter of tenure. Ms. Hirschberg, Dr. Hirschberg, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for being here. And any comments you have on this bill before us on tenure?
And for the record, my name is Diane Hirschberg, and I am the director of the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research at ICER. And just wanted to share that I believe I told your committee earlier, this session, we've been surveying teachers across the state on a variety of issues that have to do with their perceptions of working conditions and the link to their decision to stay or leave from their schools. And we did actually ask them whether or not the proposed changes to the teacher tenure system would affect their decisions about their jobs. And we asked, this is a survey that we've done kind of in pieces. We did a group of rural districts and teachers last spring, then we did teachers in the five big districts in the fall, and then we did another group in the spring again. And we asked a slightly different question with the teachers in the urban or big districts, in that we, when we asked them if this would affect their decision, we offered them a I don't know enough about the proposal, as well as yes, no, or maybe. And I'm not quite sure why we asked it differently, because I wasn't involved in that decision on this survey question. But that said, we ended up with about over, we've got close to 1,600 responses on the survey, and I looked at it both overall, and then one of my colleagues said, well, it doesn't matter to teachers who have tenure, right? And I said, you know, yeah, it might affect how they view things generally somewhat, but let's talk about first-year teachers. And so if I look at the rural respondents who were first-year teachers, and that's 155 out of a total of 558 who responded on this question, 19% of them said that new teacher tenure rules are going to impact their views of and or their decision to stay or go. And another 39% said maybe. And the problem with that maybe is I'm going to guess that a lot of those are people who don't understand really what the impact is. When we looked in the five big districts, this was where it was surprising to me, because as you know, teacher turnover rates are way, way higher in our rural districts than in our big districts. And that's obviously a kind of gross statement, because we have some rural districts, especially in Southeast, with fairly low turnover. But generally, when you look at what we call rural versus urban, it's very different. But in the five big districts, the overall response is about 890 teachers. 16% said yes, this would affect their view, and 22% said they're not familiar with the proposal. But of first-year teachers, it's about 109 first-year teachers, 20% said yes, this affects their view, and 30% said they don't know enough, and 18% said maybe. And I thought that that change to 20% was significant, in that we don't have a turnover problem right now so much in our urban districts. We have a lot more teachers who are tenured, a lot more who are experienced. As we know, there's been not very much hiring happening in certainly Anchorage and Juneau. And yet, for those teachers who are first-year teachers, they're worried about, at least a chunk of them are worried about this. And, you know, we don't necessarily want to be encouraging teachers to say, I'm not going to make it to 5 years. What happens? You know, I'm worried that I can't make it to 5 years. So that is not a statement on quality. And I understand that there's a lot of concern about being able to measure the quality of our teachers before we give them tenure. But I also think that's something that needs to be done as a partnership with the university and a partnership with the districts, so that we can do an effective job of measuring the quality, perhaps without setting up a situation that is going to make teachers more anxious. We saw a lot of teachers leave when we had the brief implementation of the teacher evaluation system with the videotaping, especially from rural Alaska. These changes kind of do affect how teachers view whether or not it's worth trying to stay longer, especially in our rural communities. But as I think this data is showing, even in our more urban communities, it could have an impact. I think the other piece is there a companion piece that goes with this that says we're strengthening professional development and support, so that those of you who are coming in nervous about getting to tenure in 5 years also are assured that you're getting sufficient support to make it possible for you to really flourish in your job.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hirschberg. I apologize for our carrying on so late here, but we'll if I have any questions as the committee has them, we'll get to you and would appreciate some input from you later. But again, Dr. Hirschberg, thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you, and I actually really appreciated the earlier conversation, so I was very happy to listen.
That was very interesting. I do want to thank all of those who signed up to testify that we're not getting to today. Andy Holloman, Anchorage Education Association, Ron Furrer from the president of NEA Anchorage, Joseph Boyle, Matsu Education Association president. Thank you all. And we will come back to this issue. And at this point, we are holding the bill for further discussion.